Okay, I think we can start now. Well, welcome everybody to Chempaka Buddhist Lodge. Those of you who are visiting here, just for this evening, and those of you who are on retreat, this evening I'm going to be talking about mindfulness. How to empower your mind. And again, the talks I'm giving here of an evening are mostly to do with the meditation practice, but they're also things which you can make use of in your daily life. What mindfulness is that ability to be clearly aware of what's going on, to be sensitive, to know deeper than ordinary people can do. And when we are mindful, we can become so sensitive to the other people that sometimes people think we've got psychic powers, but it's not psychic powers. It's mindful powers. In other words, these are ordinary qualities of the mind which everybody can develop, but which can give you a lot of success both in meditation and in daily life. Really what is happening here is you're fully listening to what's going on. That's why that I've been talking in a meditation retreat to something we call total listening. Total listening means that when someone's saying something, we are listening with everything we've got. In other words, we are not listening to the thoughts and the commentaries which go on in our mind. We're actually listening to what's really happening. We're becoming sensitive, fully aware, awake, alert, which means that if it's in business or in meditation, or in monk business, that's my business, monk business, not monkey business, monk business. It means that we're always very successful because we're alert. Even in marriage, if you're very mindful, you can actually understand what your partner is thinking without them even saying it. And you can have a long and happy marriage. Mindfulness is powerful in all situations. It reminds me of a story of this couple in Australia who've been married for 60 years. And they ask, how come you can live in happiness or live together for such a long time? Have you ever had an argument? And the husband said, only once. And ever since then, for 60 years, we haven't argued at all. How can you do that? They said. He said, I'll tell you. When we first got married 60 years ago, we went on honeymoon. We went on honeymoon to the Grand Canyon in the United States. When we started descending into the canyon on donkeys, my wife's donkey tripped. And my wife looked at that donkey and said with a very firm tone, "That's the first time." A few minutes later, the donkey stumbled again. And my wife looked at the donkey and said firmly, "That's the second time." And about 10 minutes later, the poor donkey tripped a third time. My wife never said anything. She got off the donkey, got out a gun and shot the donkey dead. And the husband said, and I said, "What did you do that for?" And my wife said, "Husband, that's the first time." Never had any argument ever since. Now that may be one way to keep a marriage together. But because of fear, he was very mindful, very alert, never to have an argument with his wife. Because it's true that sometimes we do the wrong things because we forget ourselves. Sometimes we forget to turn off our mobile phones because of lack of mindfulness. So please turn off your mobile phones. So what mindfulness does, it keeps us alert to what's really important. Now for those of you who are meditating, there's a waste of time actually trying to meditate if you don't really know what's going on. The first thing you have to do is actually to know what's occurring. And that's the job of mindfulness, to know. Now, the wonderful thing with this practice of meditation is that your mindfulness during the meditation course will get stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a strange thing that people think they're aware, but a lot of times they're living in a cloud. They're half asleep. That's what happens in our life. And because we're half asleep, we make so many mistakes. We trip over things. We make mistakes in business. We make mistakes in our relationships. We even make mistakes in our health. You know, every time you get sick, the body tells you beforehand, it says, quieten down, take it easy, you're rushing around too hard. The body tells you very often, but too often we're not listening. And that's why people get sick. So it's very important to be alert, to be aware, to wake up. And when you wake up, you can see so many more things which you never saw before. So this is actually why we practice this mindfulness, this alertness. Again, you find the slower you go, the more you see. As you rush through life, you see very little. There's too much going on. But as you slow down, the life becomes clear to you, and you begin to see much more, and you remember much more. It must have been that as a young man, I had natural mindfulness, because I did very well at school, in university. I didn't need to do too much study or revision, because when the teacher was giving the lecture, I was fully alert to what was being said. I didn't have too much inner commentary inside, because when you have an inner commentary, you're not really listening to the words. There's an old story from the Taoist tradition of Lao Tzu was taking one of his disciples, a young man, on a walk one evening. They had a golden rule that when you went on a walk with the master, you had to keep absolutely quiet. No one could say anything. As they were going on a walk this evening, they were walking through the woods, they came to the ridge, and there was this wonderful sunset. When the young student saw the sunset, he couldn't help himself but saying, "Wow, look at that beautiful sunset." He'd broken the golden rule. And because of that, the master turned around and would never let that young man go on a walk with him ever again. When the other student said, "Aren't you being a bit too harsh?" The master explained, "Listen, when that student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. All he was doing was looking at the words. There's a lot of difference between seeing a sunset and seeing the words, 'What a beautiful sunset.'" This is why we have to be careful not to look at the words, but to look at the thing in itself. Mindfulness has got no words, no description. It just knows it without saying anything. If you can do that while you're listening to a lecture, you'll find you'll be able to remember everything. Because there's nothing, there's no words, there's no activity between the words and the brain. It all goes in. It's called total listening. So instead of just thinking about things, one soaks all the information in. And that's what I was doing naturally at school and at university. The lecturer would say something and everything would go in. And when it came to exam time, everything would come out easily without me thinking about it. You'd read the question, make the mind quiet, and it would come out very easily. Which is why that people who send their children to the Dhamma schools and they learn meditation, You are giving your children a competitive advantage. In other words, you're teaching them how to learn well. We've got quite a few people teaching meditation in Australian schools. And even though they may be Christian schools, the principals are more than happy to have their kids learn Buddhist meditation. You know why? Because they get better results. And when they get better results, the principal can get an increase in his salary. It's a win-win situation all the way. Because it's true. When you learn how to meditate, you learn how to be mindful, how to be fully alert, how to understand exactly what's going on. That's why we call it awareness. And so there's many people. I told a story a couple of days ago about this woman who was in my retreat in Perth last month. She went to Melbourne University and she always got the top marks. I think it was in medicine or was it in business, I forget which. Actually, medicine is business these days, I suppose. But she always got the top marks, simply because when she went to the lectures, she really listened. Now that's actually how to do well in business, with this degree of mindfulness. But that mindfulness has to be very, very strong. The more still you are, the more that mindfulness sees, the stronger it gets. As the mindfulness gets stronger, what you see gets more and more deep, more and more powerful. It's not just that you can remember things easily, it's also you can actually see deeper into the nature of things. When I started meditating, I told you about one of the first meditation, I think I told you this morning, that one of the first meditation retreats I did was in England. And one of the things I noticed, when you start meditating, the food starts to taste more delicious. And the reason I said this was actually to show what happens when your senses become more alert, more aware. When you meditate, whatever you eat is far more delicious. So all of you sitting in the back there who like your food, if you want to like your wife's food even more, spend half an hour meditating before dinner and that food will be so nice. Because sometimes if we're rushing around, that we can't taste the food. We're just too busy thinking about it. Our mind is not sensitive, it's dull because we work too hard. It's why when people go to five-star restaurants, you should tell the people you go with to be quiet. Because you're busy tasting the food. You don't want to be distracted, especially when you pay a lot of money for food. If it's a cheap restaurant, KFC or something, you can bring your partner along and they can speak as much as they like to take your mind away from the taste of the food. But if it's delicious food, tell them to be quiet. So if you go out for a romantic dinner in a very expensive restaurant, tell your boyfriend, shut up. I'm eating, I'm being mindful. Now what's happening here is because you're being sensitive, the awareness starts to grow. Now to understand what's happening here, especially for the meditators, this is where I start to talk about the two halves of the mind. Those two parts of the mind I've mentioned in brief already, called the doer and the knower. To recap, the doer is the active part of the mind. That which thinks, which manages, which reacts to what you're experiencing. The reactor. In other words, you hear something and you think about it. What should I do about this? You feel something and you scratch. You taste something, you swallow, whatever it is. Now, that active part of the mind is only half the mind. The other part of the mind is just knowing. Awareness. When you understand the two halves of the mind, what mindfulness is just that half which just knows, which is aware, which receives the information. That which can hear, that which can see, that which can smell, taste, touch, that which can know. That's why I call it the Noah. Now, when you're meditating, you're actually suppressing the doer. That's why we call it letting things be, letting things go. The active part of the mind is being quietened down. So, when you feel a feeling in the body, you leave it alone. When you see a sight, you don't react to it. When anything comes up, you don't do anything. You're suppressing the doer. Now this is only in meditation. In daily life, you have to do a lot. And I have to do a lot. I'm a very active monk. I'm a CEO monk. And actually, I've got a franchise of the oldest multinational corporation in the world, the Buddhist Sangha. It's true. We started multinational corporations because the Buddhist Sangha went from country to country. We've got different CEOs, and I've got the franchise in Western Australia. And it's hard work. I had to work very hard building up our monasteries. But when it's time to be still, I know how to let go. How to be still. The trick of life is when there's something to do, you give everything you've got. When there's nothing to do, you're peaceful. You don't do anything. Now, I've wrote many stories about that in my little book, Opening the Door of the Heart. One of those wonderful stories, which some of you have heard before, is the story of the man who was running through the forest, being chased by a tiger. Remember that story? Being chased, there's an important thing you should all know about tigers. Two things you should know about tigers. Number one, they eat you. They look at you as their dinner. And number two, they can run much faster than you can. So if you're being chased by a tiger, you're in big trouble. And actually, I'm going to go off onto another story before I finish this story. It shows you actually what mindfulness is and what pride is. Because this is one of the old stories which I learned from the old monks in Thailand. Because I've already taught you, those people doing meditation, about the meditation on Buddha. When you're breathing in, you think Buddha. Breathing out, to, Buddha, Buddha. And there was this one monk. He was one of these Thai forest monks who go wandering from place to place. He arrived at the village late one evening. And it was always a custom when you were wandering from place to place looking for solitude to meditate, you would always go to the nearest village in the evening to say that you were there. And they'd usually tell you a nice place to meditate in the jungles. And they'd also let you... They'd also make arrangements for your morning meal. So they'd expect you in the morning when you came for alms food. So having arrived in this village, he checked in with the headman, announced he'd come so they could get some meal for him in the morning, and he asked for a suitable place to stay in the forest close to the village at night. And the headman said, look, it's best you stay in the village because there's some very dangerous tigers around here. And they might eat monks. And he said, I'm not afraid of tigers. I'm a monk. I'm a forest monk. I'm a meditating forest monk. Tigers, I'm not afraid of them. And the headman said, yeah? He said, yeah. Really? Really? Okay. If you're not afraid of tigers, we're going to see if that's true or not. And they took this monk about 3 or 4 kilometers from the village to where the road crossed the tiger trail. Now those tigers, because they're big animals, they make paths through the jungles. And they put that monk right next to the tiger trail. If you're not afraid of tigers, let's prove it. And so they left that monk there. Sitting on a little bench underneath his mosquito net as he meditated in the evening. When the sun went down, he was very peaceful in his meditation, doing the meditation on Buddha. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. along with the breath. Breathing in, boom. Breathing out, doh. As he got more and more peaceful, the breath got more and more refined. Boom, doh. But after the sun had gone down, that's the time the jungle animals come out. First of all, there were small animals. After a while, he started hearing the big animals. After a while, he started to hear a very big animal coming in his direction. Buddho changed to Buddho, Buddho, Buddha, Buddho. That being, that animal, came even closer. And as it came closer, he could pick up the sound. That was a big animal. Buddho, 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 Buddho. And when it came even closer, he couldn't help but opening his eyes. And he saw about 10 meters in front of him, this huge monk-eating tiger. And Buddho, Buddho, Buddho changed to tiger, 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 tiger. And that's where you lose your mindfulness. He forgot what he was doing. And before he noticed it, he was running away, saying, tiger, 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 tiger. Now, monks are not supposed to run. It's against our rules. You know why the Buddha made a rule that monks are not allowed to run? Because these robes of ours, they're not, they've got no buttons and no zips. So if you start running, things start falling off. But he wasn't really caring about his robes. He was caring about the tiger running after him. Tiger, tiger, tiger. And in the couple of kilometers it took to get into the village, first of all his robes slipped off. And it dragged behind him. And soon his outer robe was left, trailing along the path somewhere. And then, because of running so much, even his lower robe dropped off and trailed behind. And then this monk, who was not afraid of tigers, appeared in the village, shouting at the top of his voice, tiger, 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 tiger! And everything, including his fear, was very apparent for everybody to see. He had no clothes on at all. He was a naked monk who wasn't afraid of tigers. Now the point is, in that story, apparently that was a true story. That was told to me by Ajahn Juan, one of the famous Thai forest monks. And of course, he became the monk who wasn't afraid of tigers, who lost all his robes. And while everybody in the village, including the young girls and the old girls, when he was going, tiger, tiger, they looked out their windows and guess what they saw? But the point of the story was, he lost his mindfulness. Now, I forget where I started, with tigers. Yeah, this was the other story about a person being chased by a tiger in the jungle. The tiger was catching up on him. And fortunately, at the last moment, he saw a well in the middle of the jungle. He had no choice. The tiger was almost upon him. So, out of desperation, he jumped into the well. But as soon as he jumped in, he realized he'd made a big mistake. That well was dry. And at the bottom of that well, there was a big black snake. Oh, yeah. So, just an automatic reaction, he grabbed to the side of the well. Unfortunately, he managed to grab hold of a root, a tree root which was poking through the side of the well. It broke his fall, but it also disturbed a snake underneath him. When he came to his senses, he was holding on to the root. He looked down, and the snake, having been disturbed, had raised its head, had opened its hood, and was trying to strike him at his feet. But his feet were just too high. The snake just couldn't reach him. That was lucky. And then he looked up. The tiger wouldn't give up that easy. The tiger was leaning over the well, trying to paw him. But his hand was just too low. The snake couldn't reach him. Now if you think that's big trouble, listen to what happened next. When he came to his senses, with a tiger above him and a snake below him, he saw coming out of a hole in the side of the well two mice, a black mouse and a white mouse. And those mice started to chew on his root, making it thinner and thinner and thinner. He didn't have much time left. But another thing happened. Because the tiger was trying to paw him from above, the back of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. On a branch of that tree was a bee's nest. Because it shook, the bee's nest was right above the well. Because it started shaking, honey started dripping into the well. And so he put out his tongue, and he tasted that honey. Mmm, how delicious. And that was the end of the story. And the reason why that Buddhist story is one of my favorites is, number one, it showed what mindfulness is, enjoying the moment. Even though you've got a tiger up above you, and a snake underneath you, and the black and white mice signify night and day change, is actually chewing on your precarious hold on life. Every day you're getting older, closer to your death. Since you came here, you're 2 days closer to your funeral. And also, I like saying this is death meditation, mindfulness on death. I always, when I have an audience like this, I look at how many people are here. Maybe around 200, maybe 250 this evening. I do a quick calculation, and according to statistics, 3 of you will be dead by next year. Which 3 is it? And don't just look at the old ones. So, time is taking away, you know, your precarious hold on life. So this man, a tiger above him, a snake underneath him, and the mice, day and night, were chewing away at his hold on life. But, mindfulness, grab the moment. Mmm, what beautiful honey that is. Why is it that we worry so much about what's happening in the future? Why do we always worry about the past with guilt? Can't we let go of the past and future and be mindful in the present moment, enjoy the honey of now? All of you on retreat here, isn't this wonderful when you're on retreat? You haven't got a husband to nag you. You haven't got a wife to nag you. You don't have to worry about your housework or your children. Isn't it beautiful being free? In the time of the Buddha, when a woman became a bhikkhuni, a nun, they used to say, it was one of their ways of talking, they'd say, when you become a nun, you give up the 3 crooked things. Many of the nuns wrote these beautiful poems when they were enlightened of how peaceful it is to get rid or to abandon the 3 crooked things. You know what those 3 crooked things were in early Buddhism? The first crooked thing was the broom, signifying or symbolizing housework. When you became a nun, you didn't have any housework to do. just like now. No housework. Oh, isn't it lovely? The second crooked thing was the ladle they used for the soup, for the curries, symbolizing cooking. All you women on this retreat don't have to cook anything. All you have to do is eat it. Isn't that wonderful? So you've given up the second crooked thing, which was the ladle. And the last crooked thing they gave up was the husband. Those were the three crooked things in Buddhism. Number one, housework. Number two, cooking. Number three, the husband. Even in those days, they had a sense of humor. So now you're free. Who knows what's going to happen next? So enjoy every moment. That's called mindfulness. And anyway, even though that's life, sometimes life is like that. You don't know what's going to happen next. Sometimes it looks terrible. Sometimes it might be that, you know, the tax man is knocking at your door because you haven't paid your taxes. Maybe you've got sort of the cancer. Maybe you're about to die, become bankrupt, or whatever else has happened. Sometimes life looks like it's going to be terrible. It is like you've got a tiger above you and a snake underneath you, with nothing to do. When you're in a crisis like that, always remember to enjoy the honey of the moment. To enjoy this moment. Because who knows what is going to happen next. Now, well, I'm going to pause in a moment because we've got a Venerable come. Venerable, do you want to take a seat? Do you want to take a seat, please, Venerable? Welcome here to my talk this evening. I'm sure there's a seat somewhere. You can take this one if you want to carry on the talk. Please come up. Got a chair somewhere or a seat? Very good. Here it goes. Welcome. Okay. Whichever side. Okay. Very good. Okay. Now let's get back to the well with the snake. Because the future is uncertain. When I heard that story, that's how I heard it. It stopped right there, just like real life. However, I worked out my ending to the story. You know, I'm a monk with a very, very positive attitude. So what I thought would happen was this. When those mice were chewing it thinner and thinner and thinner, when the snake was stretching more and more and getting closer and closer to his feet, when the tiger was leaning over more and more and getting so close to his hands, the tiger leant a little bit too much. And he fell into the well, broke its neck and crushed the snake to death at the same time. It could happen. Life is full of unexpected things. And so, the man could, with the snake dead and the tiger dead, the man could climb out and go home. Why worry? You never know what's going to happen next. And that is our life. So what mindfulness is, we let go of the past and the future. Who knows what's going to happen? We enjoy the moment. And this is actually what mindfulness does. It empowers your mind to actually enjoy life. To be able to taste the honey. Strange. Sometimes people go on holiday. They look forward to going on holiday. Say they come to Australia and they come and visit me. They plan and look forward to coming. And they plan going to the airport. When they're on the plane, they're looking forward to coming to Perth. When they're in Perth, they're missing home, so they're looking forward to coming back again. They never enjoy themselves. They're always the one or two steps ahead of themselves. Now, to show you what I mean here, when you were eating your lunch today, what were you doing? Were you really mindful in the moment? A lot of people, when they eat their lunch, aren't mindful at all. What I mean by that is they got one morsel of food inside their mouth, chewing it. They got another piece of food on their spoon, waiting to go in next. They got another piece heaped up, that's number three, and they're choosing what's going to be number four. They're one or two spoons ahead of themselves. And what you're chewing, you're never really looking. You're looking at what you're going to have next. Now, if you're really mindful, one spoon at a time, one experience at a time, and then you're actually living life. You are mindful. You're alert. You're enjoying this moment instead of rushing to get rid of it. We rush so much to get rid of our moments that sometimes life goes past so quickly. We're 20 years old, 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old. And we say, where did it all go? When you're about 30 or 40, you're over the hill. And you know, as you go further down the hill, you pick up speed. Only if you're not mindful. If you're mindful, you tend to slow down and you savor the last moments of your life, which get longer and longer, as you get more and more peaceful. And you're empowering your life with happiness. As you become more still, more mindful, strange things happen. Not only does the food taste more beautiful, but what you see becomes more delightful. This is the experience which happened to me on my first meditation retreat. We were allowed to go on a walk for exercise every morning. Because our meditation room was very, very small. We were cramped up there. We couldn't do walking meditation, so we had to do it outside in the streets of Cambridge, in a university town about 35 years ago. So I knew that town because I was a student there. So I decided to go to the botanical gardens, which were only about 5 minutes walk away. However, that first morning, when I went to the gardens, I only got as far as the entrance. At the entrance was this beautiful clump of bamboo. In fact, it was the most beautiful piece of bamboo I'd ever seen. Its shape, you know, like a bamboo, it's just so slender. It just rises thick at the bottom and it gradually gets more and more slender till it tapers in a bend at the top. It's just so beautiful the way it bent. And the little branches coming off were just so well arranged. And it was like one of those Chinese watercolors, but in real life. And the richness of the colors just blended against the blue sky above. And there was a slight breeze as it swayed like a dancer in the wind. I was captivated by it. I actually stood still, mesmerized by the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen. I realized that if anyone saw me, they'd take me away to the hospital. So I sat down on a chair and just spent the whole time I was supposed to be walking staring at this beautiful piece of bamboo. I had to leave it because it was breakfast time. And so after about 50 minutes of watching this piece of bamboo, I rushed back to breakfast. The next morning I went there again. Same thing happened. For the 9 days of the retreat, 8 mornings, I went and just stood in awe of the most beautiful piece of bamboo in the world. When the retreat was over, when I went back to studies, I had a free afternoon about a week or two later. So I decided, had a free afternoon, I'm going to go and see the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world, my old friend. So I got on my bicycle. Those of you who've ever been to Cambridge know all the students have bicycles. I got on my bicycle and managed to weave through the heavy traffic and got to that beautiful clump of bamboo, the entrance to the botanical gardens. And there at the gardens, I saw the most pathetic, miserable, dirty, grungy clump of bamboo. The beautiful piece of bamboo had disappeared. There was this grungy one there instead. It was dry, withered, dull. And I wonder what's happened. It was exactly the same tree. But what had happened? Because I wasn't meditating anymore, because I just rushed through the Cambridge traffic, because I was stressed out, because I was tired, my mind just couldn't see the beauty anymore. It had closed. And all I saw was see the beauty anymore. It had closed. And all I saw was an ordinary piece of bamboo. It was such a profound experience for me that I contemplated it for a long time. Later on, when I became a monk, I started to see such beauty in the ordinary things many more times. Sometimes my mind got so still that mindfulness grew so strong that I looked even a piece of concrete and became the most wonderful, beautiful piece of concrete I'd ever seen in the whole world. Now I know what's happening. When the mindfulness is weak, whatever you see is dull and boring. Just like a clump of bamboo, or like ordinary food. When the mindfulness starts to grow, you see much more of what you're experiencing. Things fill out, colors become richer, tastes become more blown, full-blown taste. You feel more, you see more, you hear more, you know more. It's what I now call superpower mindfulness. Not ordinary mindfulness, but superpower mindfulness. I've read in the magazines that nowadays that people are making all these movies about the superheroes. They've got Batman, they've got Superman. I saw in the In-Flight magazine they've got Catwoman now. It's only a matter of time before they have the ultimate superhero, Supermonk. Supermonk, who's so wise, who's got the X-ray vision of superpower mindfulness, who can read people's minds, who can levitate through the air, who can save people, not with the power of violence, but with wisdom. Anyone who wants to make a lot of money, I can share the franchise. Supermonk flies again. It'd be great, wouldn't it? Because not only, this is actually a serious proposition. If you get like Supermonk, that it's not just one of these ordinary sort of superheroes you see in Hollywood who's always beating people up and fighting. Because the end, after having saved the world from the evil Dr. Mara, or some, whatever you should call it, anti-hero, then he teaches a nice Dhamma lesson. So our kids see a nice movie, and at the end, they hear some Dhamma. So it'd be wonderful to have Supermonk as the next superhero. But it's true, you get superpower mindfulness. What you see much more deeply. And this is where you start to understand yourself and understand others. When your mindfulness starts to grow, and you experience this, when you get still, you become more awake. It's like turning up the lights in your mind. You start, if we turn the lights down in this room, you just see shapes. You wouldn't really realize who was who. When you turn the lights up, you can actually see more clearly. When you really turn the lights up, you can see all the pimples on the beautiful girls. And you can see that some of the beautiful men have got false teeth. When you turn the lights up even more, you can see who's shaved and who hasn't shaved. I'm talking about the girls as well as the boys. Because superpower mindfulness actually sees the truth of things. It's turning up the lights, the bright lights. Which is why you become wise with superpower mindfulness. You see things as they truly are. But sometimes you've got to be careful because sometimes people don't like to see the truth. They like to live in dark places, like nightclubs. Why is it that young men and women, or middle-aged men and women, like to have a romantic evening in a candlelit restaurant or walk by the river under the moonlight? Oh, isn't that romantic? Why is it in dance halls and nightclubs it's always dark? You know why? Because in that dim light where you can hardly see anything, you just can't see your girlfriend's pimples. You can't see the grey in his hair because it's very dim, and because you fantasize that your partner on the opposite end of the table, ooh, it's so dim you can actually fantasize that he's a superstar from Hollywood. She is like one of these girls you see on the magazines. Have you ever looked at those glossy magazines? Have you ever seen anyone like that in real life? They don't exist. That's all done by light and touch-up. Digital enhancement. So, such people don't exist, but we want them to exist. Because we want them to exist, we change our mindfulness. We don't see what's truly there, we see what we want to see. That's called wishful thinking or denial. When we have superpower mindfulness, we see things as they truly are. That way, we can accept life and be with life. Not only do you actually see your body and see what you're doing to it, so much sickness comes because we don't look to see what we're doing to our body. There was this man who was 100 years of age in New York, and he was interviewed by the newspaper, and they said, well, now you're 100 years, have you got any advice to people? He said, yes, I've got this advice. Now I'm 100, if only I knew I was going to live that long, I would have taken much better care of myself. Because when you get old, you have to live with all the aches and pains of not looking after yourself when you were young. So, look after yourself. Be caring and careful. And then when you're mindful, you don't tend to get so ill and sick. Okay? Because you're mindful, you see what you're doing. If you're tired, you take a rest. If you've got a cold, sort of you take some more fruit or something. But when you don't know what you're doing, sometimes the only time you notice you are ill is when it's a bit too late. So mindfulness means you become much more healthy. Not only that, but you become much more sensitive to even the people you deal with in business. You know one of the troubles in business? Sometimes you can't trust anybody. How can you know whether that person is going to pay you after you deliver the goods? How can you know that the goods you're buying is what they say they are? When you've got superpower mindfulness, it's not psychic powers, you're so alert, you pick up signs which other people don't pick up. You know, when you lie, sometimes the eyes move very rapidly. If you've got mindfulness, you can pick that up straight away. That guy is not telling the truth. If you smile naturally, it's very different than a forced smile. So, if your husband comes late home from work and he says, oh, lovely to see you, dear, you can tell whether he's telling the truth or whether he's not telling the truth. You can become more alert and more aware. You know what's going on, for goodness sake. You don't need to hire a detective. Superpower mindfulness is your detective. And you become much more successful in life. You're more alert, more aware. You see much more. And if you want to find out the truths of existence, if you want to find out the religious truths, and find out who's right and who's wrong, is it the Christians? Is it the Buddhists? Is it the Hindus? Which one has got the right truth? You need to have superpower mindfulness, first of all. To have that bright mind which sees deeper and further than other people do. So you can find out for yourself. I know that some people, especially in places like Australia, they come to my Buddhist temple. They also go to church. And they also go to the mosque and the Hindu temple as well. It's called Just In Case. But don't be seen like that. You waste too much time. You can find out for yourself by developing mindfulness, which is so strong. You can find out what's true and what's false. You can turn up the lights. And you can know who's telling the truth and who isn't. You can be alert, be awake.
So what that does, that empowers you with wisdom. You see deeper and further than the ordinary person. And if you want to find out the deeper truths, you can get such powerful mindfulness when you have really powerful mindfulness, so you can look at this floor and it becomes the most beautiful pattern you've ever seen in your life. Then you can do some interesting things. If you've empowered your mind to that degree of stillness and intensity, you can do such things as say, "What is my earliest memory?" I've had great success in this, because when your mind is still and powerful like that, you say, "What's my earliest memory?" And after a second or two, a vision appears in your mind of a time long, long ago. I have to be careful here, because I'm not allowed, according to my monastic rules, to talk about the deeper experiences which I've had as a monk. Things like past lives or other supernatural phenomena, I have to keep quiet. But if you want to know, there is a trick of finding out. I can tell other monks, but I can't tell you. So you ask my other monks, the friends, "Hey, what has Ajahn Brahm done?" That's how you find out. But what I can say is, one of the first times I did this, because it's not a past life, it's just close. One of the first times I did this, I was really nice, powerful mindfulness. Your mind is very bright and energetic and still. You look at things, you look at a flower, and my goodness, that's so beautiful. The yellows are just so rich, as if they've all been polished, as if they're iridescent yellow. That's what it feels like to have superpower mindfulness. Whatever you see, whatever you taste, is so rich. So I asked myself, "What is my earliest memory?" And straight away, within a few seconds, I had a smell in my nose. It wasn't a smell of the hall in which I was sitting. It was a strange smell, but I recognized it immediately. It was the smell of my baby's pram. And with that smell and that recognition, I had my eyes closed, I was in meditation, I was back as a baby in a pram, reliving the experience. And then, as the smell was recognized as my baby's pram, you could actually visualize your pram. Now, I hadn't been in that pram for about 30 years, but now I could see it so clearly, I knew its smell, and I could even see my favorite toy as a baby, which was a little blue plastic toy called Porky. It was a little pick which rattled, and my mother would delight me just walking the toy and rattling it again and again. I had all my baby memories back very, very clearly. This is actually what happens when you have superpower mindfulness. You can go back to your early life. You can go back to the time you were born and know what it's like coming out of your mother's womb. You can actually see what it's like in the mother's womb. And you can even go back further to your previous lives. When your mind is that powerful with superpower mindfulness, that's what you can do. And it's not that difficult. And it's fascinating. There's one Malaysian girl who lives in Perth who had this. She did this on one of my retreats. She's starting to get some good meditation. The mindfulness was getting very, very powerful. So, you know, she started seeing the grass outside start to fluoresce. It was just so bright and beautiful. So I asked her, "Okay, you're ready to do, what's your earliest memory?" And what she got straight away was, again as a baby, in her mother's arms, being cradled. She felt her mother there being cradled. But then she looked up at her mother, and she was shocked. Because the woman who was cradling her was not her mother. Saw it very clearly. She thought, "Uh-oh, what has my mother not told me?" She thought she must have been adopted. Because people do that, they adopt children and they don't tell them. And there she got this old memory when she was just newly born, being cradled by someone who she couldn't recognize at all. So she told me in the interview time, and she couldn't wait to get back home and confront her mum. And she did that. When the retreat was finished, she went to see her mother and said, "Mother, are you really my mum?" And her mother was shocked. "What do you mean? Of course I'm your mum. Now tell me the truth. Am I adopted?" And her mother said, "What are you talking about?" And she told the experience. In that meditation, she developed superpower mindfulness, and she remembered a time when she was a baby, looking up into the eyes of someone who was not her mother. So her mother said, "Describe that woman." And she described this woman in perfect detail, because when you have this superpower of mindfulness, your memory is so sharp, it's so good. It's like, you know, if any of you have had a car accident, you also get superpower mindfulness out of fear. It just, the memory burns itself into your mind. You can't forget it. That's actually similar, but this is like beautiful superpower mindfulness, only pleasant. And so she could remember that image very easily. And so she asked her mum, or she told her mum what this woman looked like. And as soon as she described her, her mother was very impressed. "How do you know that? That was your amma, your nurse. She came from a rich family in Kuala Lumpur. When she was born, her mother, who was a socialite, hired a nurse for her. Only for the first few months. And she remembered perfectly and could describe it to her mother's satisfaction. Yeah, that was your nurse." It was one of those beautiful cases where it showed that that memory of many, many years ago was perfect in all its detail, enough to convince your mother, yeah, that was a nurse you'd only had in the first few months of your life. Superpower mindfulness can do that, and it can get you back into your past life. And then you will know for yourself that you haven't just lived one life. You know as a fact you've been born before. And it's not out of faith. It's not because you believe in books. It's not because you believe Ajahn Brahm or anybody else. It's because you know it for yourself. And it's too many people actually just doubt reincarnation these days. And that actually shows you which religions are telling the truth and which ones aren't. And you can find it out for yourself. And it's very important too. It has consequences. If you know you're going to be reborn again because you were born before, this is not your first life, so it means this is not going to be your last life, then you better start behaving. You better start putting some money in the donation box. That's called your insurance policy. It's like when you got a car, you got insurance, haven't you? In case the car gets stolen, if you've got a really good insurance policy and you've kept up the premiums, if your car gets stolen or it crashes, you can get a payout so you can get an even better car in the future. So if you've done lots of good karma in this life, when your body dies, you can get a much better model next time. But if you haven't done good karma, if you haven't done charity, and you haven't kept your precepts, it's like not paying your insurance premium. When this car, your body dies, the next time you probably only get a bicycle. But you know that is true because it's your own experience in meditation. This is what superpower mindfulness can do. And superpower mindfulness can go even deeper and find out the nature of your mind. Your awareness is so bright. You can see more deeply into things. It's not just seeing the beauty in a flower, but it's seeing what happens in your mind. It's like you brighten up the headlights and you can see everything which you think you are. What this being is which you take to be you. That's why that mindfulness, when it's enhanced with the power of meditation, with the power of stillness, with the power which you develop in a meditation retreat like this, brings you immense insight. When you know what superpower mindfulness is, you understand that with ordinary mindfulness, everyday mindfulness, trying to find the truth is trying to like dig a hole with a spoon, with a teaspoon. Superpower mindfulness is like having one of these big excavators and digging a hole with that. You've got far more power, far more depth to your insight. And that's why you understand why the superpower mindfulness is essential. But it's not just superpower mindfulness to get wisdom. All your superpowers, even the psychic powers, come from this. When your mind is that strong, you can start to see other beings. You can get these psychic powers, which are very interesting, but only when your mind is very, very still and powerful. And you feel that's possible, because you know the energy of a mind which has been enhanced. So this is why mindfulness is very important. And to go back, the doer and the knower, the two halves of the mind, the reason why it becomes empowered is because we don't give any energy to doing, to making, to thinking. So all the energy, instead of being wasted in doing, in thinking, in reacting, it all flows just into knowing. It's like we have this channel of water which can go two ways. It can go into doing things or it can go into knowing things. We do so much, we've got hardly energy left for being passive and to know. That's one of the reasons why people get depressed, because they haven't got any energy left in just bare knowing. So what they know is just so dull, so grey, there's nothing which can actually enhance their happiness. If any of you have ever been to London in around this time of the year, December and January, you know how miserable it can be. First time I went back after 7 years, I went back to visit my mother at this time of the year, because it was Christmas time. I decided to go and visit her then, in December. I couldn't have chosen a worse time of the year. Those who've been to London would recognize this description. In December, the skies are all grey. You can't see any blue sky at all, it's just clouds. Even it rains, this drizzle, which is also grey. All the buildings are all grey stone. And the pavements and the roads is all grey as well. What clothes do people wear in England? Grey suits. It's all grey all over the place. And even worse, what tea do people in England drink? Earl Grey. It's all grey, it's miserable. So no wonder people at that time of the year get depressed. And apparently there's a sickness which only comes that time of the year. Just people get depressed because they can't see anything to enliven their senses. There's no colour in life. There's no richness. And my brother told me that all they did, the only therapy they did to get people out of this depression, they took them into a room with very bright lights. They all wore these Hawaiian shirts with lots of colour and lots of sound, just to get their senses awake again. And this is actually what happens, that when we're depressed, we only see grey. Understand? There's no brightness in life. When you have a relationship with your husband or your wife, you can't see any beauty in them anymore. You say, the spark has gone out of our marriage. It's just ordinary. Your husband, your wife are the same as you started with, but your mindfulness has gone down. And that's why you can't see what you've fallen in love with before. You can't see their beauty. You can't see even the beauty in life anymore. It's not life's fault. It's not your husband's fault. It's not your wife. It's not your boyfriend or girlfriend's fault. It's your fault. Wake up. Develop powerful mindfulness. You'll be able to fall in love with your partner again. You'll be able to see their beauty. You'll be able to fall in love with life again. See life's richness. It's what happens. So this is what depression is. You get superpower mindfulness. You get more energy going into the knowing. So you know more. Knowing has got more energy. Because knowing has got more energy, it's turning the wattage up of your awareness. Whatever you see more of. And when you see more of it, it's more happy. There's one thing I discovered through meditation. One of the powerful insights is energy is happiness. Mental energy is equivalent to joy. The more energy you have in the mind, the happier you are. That's one of the reasons I'm a happy monk. I've got lots of mental energy. That's why I can sit up here and talk to you for an hour and a half. 2 hours now? I don't know. Who cares? But that's why you get lots of energy when you're happy. So when the mindfulness receives all the energy, it becomes superpower mindfulness. Not only do you see deeply, but you see with happiness. Anyone who's miserable is not mindful. It's obvious to me. When you get really, really mindful, powerful mindful, you are happy. Energy is happiness. Mental energy. When the energy starts to flow into the mindfulness, that's when you start getting joyful in your meditation. You start to smile more. You become happy. And this meditation retreat really deserves its name. For those of you who haven't heard this, this meditation retreat is not called Chempaka Lodge, was the end of the year retreat. This is called Club Med PJ. Club Meditation Petaling Jaya. And it deserves the name Club Med, because Club Med is a happy place. And this is a happy place you meditate. And if by the end of this retreat you're not a happier little yogi, then I have not done my job. That's why in my meditation retreats, you know, they take group photographs during the retreat. When I do my meditation retreat, at the group photograph at the end, everyone looks miserable. Because, oh, we have to go home. Oh. Because you're enjoying it. Because the energy goes into mindfulness, you become supercharged, and you find, whether you like it or not, you are happy. You're joyful. And that's an important part of the Buddhist path. The Buddhist path is all about ending suffering, not making more suffering. Ending suffering. So you can test your progress by how much happiness you have. If you're getting happier and happier in this meditation retreat, you're making progress on the path, you're ending suffering more and more. The more you end suffering, the more happy you are. It's obvious. That's why when I was a young Buddhist, I understood that enough to go and check out the monks. Any miserable monks, I did have no faith in at all. Because if they knew the end of suffering, why are they so miserable? It's just like, you know, those advertisements. You know, when you buy the washing powder, it's supposed to make your clothes whiter. If you find out that you wash with that powder and it gets even dirtier, what good is that washing powder? So what good would Buddhism do if it makes you more miserable? So I was looking for the happy monks to see who understood the Dhamma. And I was very fortunate to see the happiest monk. Actually, the happiest person, still the happiest person I've ever seen, was my teacher, Ajahn Chah. That's why you had faith in him. That's why you spent all those years eating frog on rice and those other disgusting foods. Because there was a guy, I mean, that was really impressive. A guy who was happy, really happy. How come? Why? And then you found out why. So this power, this eightfold path, enhancing mindfulness, making it really strong, superpower mindfulness, and he was happy. Not only happy, but incredibly wise. He could see things which other people just couldn't see. Because his mindfulness was so sharp. So empowered. And if ever you look at the time of the Buddha, to check this out, one of the beautiful sutras is called the Dhammacetiya Sutta, usually translated as Monuments to the Dhamma. It tells the story of one of the important figures in the time of the Buddha, King Pasenadi of Kosala, one of the Buddha's chief supporters, who just before he passed away went to see the Buddha in the Jeta Grove Monastery, which was right next to the capital of Kosala, Sawati. And when the king walked into the monastery, the first thing he just kissed the feet of the Buddha first of all. Just all the happiness and joy he'd got in life was because of this great teacher. And one of the first things he said after this was how much he liked coming into this monastery, because all the monks in this monastery were all smiling and happy. And the Buddha said, "Yes, great king, that's how it is when you get success in your meditation." It's the Buddha's words. If your meditation is successful, you get happier. The smile gets wider, the eyes get brighter, as the mindfulness gets stronger, you get more power, and you're a happier little Buddhist. And that's by far the best way to teach Buddhism to your friends and loved ones. If you go and give them a Dharma book and say, "Read this," and you're miserable, they say, "What's the point?" But if you're happy, you don't need to actually to tell your friends and loved ones, "Oh, come to listen to the Dhamma." If you're happy, they say, "Where is it? I want to go. Take me." And that's true. Our vice president a year ago, she wrote a book about her life's journey. I was mentioned in her book because she went to see one of my talks and she saw this happy monk giving a Dhamma talk. She thought, he's only putting this on. In public he smiles, but probably he's like everybody else and gets miserable when he's not on stage. So she wrote this book. She went to check out the monks. She went to follow them to the monastery to see whether this was really real happiness or whether they got miserable sometimes. If you want to check me out, ask Mangala, who's been looking after me the last couple of days. Ask if I shouted at him and got miserable. Or Amata, his brother, sometimes looks after me in the BTF. Ask people who've not just seen me on stage, but seen me when I first get up in the morning. And then you'll know if this is a happy monk or not. But she checked it out. She found out, it's real happiness. And she wrote in her book, "I don't know what those monks were on, but I want some of it." And she became... And she became a Buddhist because of that. She saw happiness. Even some years ago, when I was visiting England, visiting my mother, there was one of the monks there. He was working in the prisons. He's doing a really good job. And he managed to convince the prison systems in UK to have what he called a Buddha Grove. What the Buddha Grove was, is actually in these open prisons with a bit of land around them, he managed to get some, I think mostly Thai supporters, to donate a Buddha statue, a big one. Some of the prisoners actually built a nice stand, planted trees around. It was a place of peace and quiet for the prisoners to reflect. And this actually was so successful, because if you're in a jail, sometimes what you don't have is just quietness, to actually to reflect on what you've done and heal the pain of your crime and become a better person. So they built these Buddha groves, and I think there's many of them, maybe 20 or 30 in the prisons in England now, all agreed to by the Home Office. Even though this is just, it's a Buddha statue, everyone realizes this is a place of peace, whether you're a Christian, a Hindu or Muslim, the prisoners go there to sit quietly and reflect. It's a Buddha grove. And of course you can imagine the good it does. That's why all the prison superintendents all support this up to the hilt. You build it, we'll maintain it. But when the first one was established, I happened to be in UK. I was invited for the opening ceremony. Now, part of the opening ceremony, as many of you Buddhists know, I've been giving the speeches. I think we had the head of the prisons there, not the Home Secretary, But I think the head of the prisons department in UK, the civil servant, and then the governor and a few other dignitaries, MPs, they all gave their speeches. And then, of course, we did some chanting, and after the chanting, we did the circumambulation. You know what we do around, like Buddha statues or stupas at Waisak Day? We go around with candles and incense, walking around three times. Now, I was so inspired. I'm very easy to get inspired by really good things, wonderful things. And as I was going around, I had this huge smile on my face. I was so happy. Now, this is Buddhism. This is compassion. This is kindness. And we're actually helping people who really need help, prisoners. What a wonderful idea. What a beautiful thing this was to have a Buddha statue inside one of Her Majesty's prisons in UK. Oh, I was so happy. And as I was going around, out of the corner of my eye, I saw two prisoners who were looking at me. They weren't Buddhists. They were saying, "You know, what's going on? Let's have a look, see what's happening." And they saw me. And I heard them as one turned to the other and they pointed to me. "He's on the gear." The gear means drugs. They looked at me and think the only way he can be that happy is to take drugs. I said, "No, I don't need drugs. Just superpower mindfulness, inspiration, the Dhamma. That's what made me happy." So this is actually what that lady saw. She saw that type of happiness, which usually you only see on people who's high on drugs or alcohol, or who's high on wisdom, peace and compassion, who's high on mindfulness. When you get that sort of happiness, please follow it. You don't get attached to that type of happiness. That is the happiness of freedom, of liberation. So the Buddha said, don't be afraid of those happinesses, indulging them. This is what's supposed to happen in your meditation. So when you get superpower mindfulness, you're going to be one happy little yogi. And that's good. Every retreat which I've taught, there's always one or two who really get happy. And it's one of the greatest gifts you can give me as a teacher. Usually what happens, they come and interview, but sometimes they can't wait for an interview. They're waiting on the path when I go back to my room. And they look at me and say, "Ajahn Brahm, I've done it." And it's so sweet, and the tears are coming out of their eyes. The more happiness than they've ever experienced before. Superpower mindfulness brings you so much happiness and joy. And that's called empowering your mind. It's part of the path. There's other things as well, but that is what I'm emphasizing today. So mindfulness is for your life, for your happiness, for your success, and even for your enlightenment. So thank you for listening. Okay, now any questions about mindfulness and superpower mindfulness? Is there a question? I'll give a special prize for the first question this evening. Who wants the first special prize? Okay, the special prize is, sir, a free haircut. Oh, you get a free haircut. No, I'll give you a free haircut. Is there a difference between mindfulness and awareness? No, there's not. Because mindfulness, you know, actually means, right, being aware. But I only focus on awareness, but awareness also comes with actually knowing what to do as well. You're mindful, you're aware, but when you see what's going on, automatically, for example, if you're very aware and about to step on a snake, because of your awareness, you'll never step on them. You go another path. So awareness will always give rise to wise action, compassionate action. So it's not just bare mindfulness or bare awareness. There's a consequence of that, which is automatic. You can't stop yourself. You'll avoid that which is harmful. You'll only do that which is good. It's exactly the same. Mindfulness and awareness. Sati. Does that make sense? Okay. You don't have to take up the free haircut. I'll absolve you of that part. Yes. Okay. How do you know you're enhancing mindfulness and you're not hallucinating? Okay, how you really know is because you get more energy, you get more happiness, and also that better things happen to you in life. You become more sensitive to others. If you're hallucinating, you're not sensitive at all to what's happening. So hallucination, that sometimes means you're not responding appropriately to what's happening in life. You know that story about the man who was not hallucinating, he was very high, but high on alcohol, in that story about the police roadblock in Sydney? Do you remember that story? Actually, I told this, I think, a year ago in KL, and apparently that somebody told the radio, and it was on the radio show the next morning. It was a story. For those of you who haven't heard it, put your hand up if you haven't heard the story of the man. Okay, very good. I'll tell it to you then. But be careful, because this has consequences. If any of you are drinkers, this might actually motivate you to stop drinking in the future. Because this was a man in Sydney who'd been drinking alcohol one evening, was driving home. Now in Sydney, as well as in Malaysia, there are laws which prohibit you drinking or sort of driving while you're drunk. This man had been drinking heavily. He was over the limit. The police were looking out for people like this. So they had a roadblock. They stopped all of the cars. He knew he was in trouble because there was no way out. If you try a U-turn, actually, I'm embarrassed to say that one of my disciples tried this one New Year's Eve. He did a U-turn, and straight away there was a police car in the bush waiting for him. And they nabbed him straight away. It's an admission of guilt. So there was no way out. He had to wait in the queue of cars to be tested. He knew he was done for. He'd been drinking so much, he was way over the limit. He'd be heavily fined and probably lose his license as well. He was resigned to his fate. When it got to his turn, he climbed out of his car, and the policeman gave him this little tube to blow into to check the alcohol level on his breath. He was about to blow into the tube when there was the sound of a car crash. Because the roadblock was a traffic hazard, there was a car which was going a little bit too fast, who couldn't brake quick enough to avoid colliding with one of the cars which was in front. There was a crash. He heard it, and so did the policeman about to test him. And the policeman said, "Sir, it's more important for me as a policeman to attend to the crash than to check your alcohol level. Get in your car and go home." He was so lucky. He came that close to being caught. But the problem wasn't over yet. Because the following morning, he woke up with a hangover at home when somebody was ringing his doorbell. He quickly got dressed. When he opened the door, he saw two New South Wales policemen waiting at the door. Straight away he was afraid, as you do when you see two policemen at your door. But then he thought, they can't arrest me now, I'm not driving. They can't prove anything. But the policeman didn't want to check his alcohol level. That all the two policemen asked was, "Sir, would you mind if we have a look in your garage?" He thought for a while. He said, "I'm not a burglar, I'm not a thief, there's nothing in my garage except my car." "Sure," he said. So he took them over to his garage, and he opened the garage door. As soon as the door was opened, he almost died of a heart attack. Because when he looked inside his own garage, it wasn't his car in his garage, there was a police car in the garage instead. He was so drunk that when he got out of the car and they said, get in your car and drive home, by mistake he got into the wrong car. They had an extra car at the police roadblock and they were missing one of their own. They soon chased it and they went down to his house and he was in big trouble. That's what happens when you hallucinate or when you get drunk. You don't know what you're doing and you make big mistakes. But you don't make those mistakes when you're mindful. And that's the difference. Okay. So hallucination, you make mistakes. Superpower mindfulness, you never make mistakes. Okay, another question? If there's no more questions, we're going to finish up for this evening. What time is it? It's only 9:30. Got a question? Yeah. Can you shout it out? Shout it out, because I can't hear you. Okay, you're asking about, according to Buddhism, the last thought is crucial to where you get reborn. What happens to those who get a sudden death, who don't have chance to get a nice last thought? Now, the first thing I say, that is actually true in one sense, your last thought is the most important. But really, your last thought is a sum total of all you've ever thought before. All your kind deeds, all your good deeds means you'll have a nice thought at the end. So don't think you could cheat karma by being a sort of a selfish, cruel, heartless, mean, devious, a rule-breaking person all your life, but just make sure the last thought's a good one. So you're never giving any charity before, never taking the 5 precepts, cheated on your wife. But on your last thought, you get the monk around, put a donation in the box right at the very end, because you don't need the money anyway, because your children are going to inherit it. So you make a donation right at the very end, just before you die, Parnati Pata Ve Ramani, Adi Nadana Ve Ramani. It's too late. You can't cheat that way. Because your last thought is the sum total of what you've been thinking before. I don't know if any of you have ever come close to death. But I remember one time, it's a classical case, this is not a cliche, when your last moments, your life flashes in front of you. Because when I was a student, I was walking in Scotland. I was alone, I was lost the path, I was walking along the cliffs in a very remote part of Scotland. Actually, I found out that no one came across that path for another 2 or 3 days. And I fell over a cliff. I lost my footing. I had a heavy backpack on, and I twisted around, and I was facing the cliff. And I was going down, down, a vertical cliff, down, down, the cliff was passing me by again and again, I thought I was dead. And at that time, the major event, I was only about 19 or 20, the major events in my life all flashed past. It seemed that I was falling forever. And this is what happened. You do actually see your past life, your life events so far. I felt, because I couldn't see what was happening, I couldn't see how far down it was, but I knew it was a long, long way. And I felt something solid under my feet. So I bent my legs to take the fall. I'd only tumbled a little bit, and I stood up. No broken bones, no cuts. It was amazing, it was a miracle. You could fall that far without any injury. And then I looked up. And the cliff was only just above my head. It was about 7 feet. It may sound funny, but it's true. That's what happened. Because when I was falling, I was afraid, I thought I was dying, and my whole perception started to change. Time went very slowly. What was only 7 foot felt to me like 70 feet. And that could only have been a couple of seconds. For me, it was about a whole minute or more. It's a strange experience. You may have had those experiences when you're having a car crash. Time slows down. So it's amazing what happens when you get close to death. Ordinary things actually change. And knowing that experience, actually you do go on autopilot if you have a sudden death. One of my disciples, she was very happy. She was going away from my monastery, driving home. Her car went on the gravel side of the road. She lost control. She flipped over 3 times. When you're in a car crash like that, you don't know what the damage is. And so actually, when the car finished rolling, she told me that she recited to herself, "Let go, let go, let go, let go, let go." Automatically. And then she realized, because there was hardly any pain, that she realized she was actually quite safe. In these modern cars, they're so safe. You know, they've got these like cell configurations where you don't get crushed, you've got your seatbelt on. So she wasn't injured at all. Her car was a write-off, but she was quite safe. But she was so happy that when she thought she was going to die, what she did was actually recite to herself, "Let go, let go, let go, let go." She knew that when the real thing happened, she'd probably do the same. It was a rehearsal, a dress rehearsal for her death. And she passed the rehearsal, the mock exam. You'll find that your death, if it's a sudden death, as you've been trained, your inclinations, all the things you've done in life, that's what will happen to you. It's a waste of time waiting till the last minute to swap for your final exam. I mean your real final exam. Like at university or like at school, if you haven't worked all the year, it's a waste of time coming to the monks and saying, "Please do some chanting because I've got my exams to be done." That's what happened some years ago. There was this, she was a, I'm not sure if it was Malaysian or Singaporean, a Chinese girl. She came to us monks for some chanting. She was doing her university exams, the end of year exams. She wanted some chanting to bring her good luck. So we did the chanting. She never gave any donation, just got the chanting. And we never saw her again. But we saw her friends who told us what happened. She was going around telling all her friends, "The monks at my monastery, Ajahn Brahman, his monks are no good." Because you know why? She failed the exam. She failed the exam. She said, "Our chanting's no good." But the point was, we found out from her friends, she hardly ever went to any lectures or any tutorials. She was only at university overseas for the parties, for the social life. And she thought the exams, the monks could take care of that part of life. You can't do it. Just chanting at the very end is not good enough. It's the same when you die. You just get the monks to do the chanting for you when you haven't done any, going to any lectures, no good karma, no generosity, not keeping the precepts, no charity work, no compassion. If you haven't done the work, you can't just swat up at the last minute and expect to pass. So what happens? If you're a good person, you have done charity work, compassion, service, you've been a good person, a good family person, a good husband, a good wife, a good parent, a good child, then your last thought will automatically be a beautiful one. You'll be unable to think a bad thought. All that you've done in your life will come together and make that last thought a beautiful one. A sudden death, a not so sudden death, is the same. So that's the answer to your question. Yeah? I didn't catch the end of it. Okay, would it be the same goal if you're a Muslim, a Christian, or a Buddhist, or whatever? It doesn't matter what you call yourself. It matters what you do, who you are. It doesn't matter whether you're a boy or a girl, old or young, Australian, Malaysian, or whatever. It's what you do which counts, not what you call yourself. Because there are some people who call themselves Buddhists, they're called Waisak Buddhists. The only time you see them in a temple is on Waisak. And there are some Christians who've never been to a temple before, but they don't know what the law of karma is, but they're so kind and generous, compassionate people. Which one do you think will go to heaven? The Christian, yeah, because they're good, they're kind. As it says in the Christian Bible, because I was brought up with Christianity, by their deeds ye shall know them. That's why it doesn't really matter just what you call yourself. It's actually what you do, your karma. If you are a kind, compassionate, good person, then you go to kind, good, compassionate places. So, this is actually our life these days, is actually modern life. If you see a good teacher, doesn't matter whether a Buddhist, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, whether a Christian, Muslim, whatever, if what they say makes sense, then follow it. No one has got the franchise on truth. The truth is out there like the air. People might try and bottle it and sell it, like people bottle water. I don't know if I should say this, I might get into trouble, but you know one of the most favourite bottled waters is called Evian water. How many of you have figured out that means naive spelt backwards? Check it out, Evian is naive spelt backwards. What are you buying? You get better water from the taps in Malaysia. So, if it's true, it must bring happiness, harmony, and peace. That's how you can know it's truth. Not just because it sounds good, but know it by its results. And if it's a monk, if it's a Buddhist, a Christian, a Muslim, whatever, if what they say is opposed to harmony, opposed to peace, opposed to tolerance, it can't be truth. So that's how you can know for yourself. Yeah. Okay, what I'd probably do, if I knew someone had got lots of bad karma, they'd been a naughty little boy or naughty girl, and they came to the monastery and said they're having an exam, and I'd say, you have to come to the chanting. Say it was like here, someone was doing an examination today, or going to an interview, and they came to me this afternoon, and they said, can we have some chanting, because I've got a very important interview for a job tomorrow morning. And I knew they'd been a bad person. I'd say, yes, come to the chanting. I'll give you the chanting at 8 o'clock. And when they came here, I'd say, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I've got to give a talk first of all. I'll give it to you afterwards. So they have to come to the talk first of all. I'd use it as a bribe, as a means to actually to let them listen to some Dhamma first of all. And that way, hopefully, that the Dhamma they listen to will actually change their life and make them into a good person. It's as if the chanting is the bait to get them into the temple to listen to some good Dhamma. So that's what I would do. I'd be deceiving, sneaky, out of compassion for them. That's why I'm sneaky, out of compassion for them. That's why I'm sneaky and devious here. That's why I tell all these jokes. It's actually to keep you here long enough I can teach you not to be naughty. Go on. Ah, but this is what devious means. It comes from the word deva. It means of the devas. Okay, any other questions? Okay, I think that's... Oh, you got one? Yes? Go on. What are the requisites? It's usually two. There must be one I haven't heard. But the two are actually the words of another and work of the mind which goes to the source. These are the two causes for the attainment of stream winning. If that's what you're meaning here. And it's a very important. The words of another is actually understanding, getting some knowledge of what the Buddha taught. And the other thing is with that map, work of the mind which goes back to the source, it's the literal meaning of yoniso manasikara. Manasikara is work of the mind. Yoni is a womb. Going to the source of things. Where did that thought come from? Where did the body come from? Where is mind? Go to the center of things. Which is why in this meditation retreat I've already mentioned that you go into the center of things to get deep meditation. To find out what the mind is. What is will? What is knowing? To go to the center of things so you can see those things for yourself and know what they are. And you use the map as your means, as your direction to go inwards. When you've got those two together, you've got the map, and you go deep within yourself, you'll find the emptiness inside. I should really give this simile later on in the talk on anatta. A long time ago I gave the simile of the driverless bus. Life, using the old simile of going on a journey, life is like going on a journey in a bus. Sometimes you're driving along the road and you look out the window and the scenery is so beautiful. It's delightful. Meadows and trees and waterfalls and a wonderful sky. And you tell the bus driver, oh look, it's so wonderful outside. Slow down. Stop. I want to enjoy this magical time. And a lot of the time, the bus driver doesn't slow down. A lot of the time, he speeds up. And other times, you're looking out the window and you see this disgusting, terrible scenery. Like a toxic waste dump, all grey and miserable. And you tell the driver, hurry up, get out of here, it's not nice. And very often, your bus driver slows down or even stops. Now, in this simile, you are like the person looking out the window of your journey. Sometimes you experience some wonderful pleasant times and you want them to last forever. But it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes the pleasant experiences, they don't last as long as they should do. The bus driver speeds up. Sometimes we have unpleasant times, painful times, disappointing times. We want to get out as soon as we can. But sometimes the unpleasantness lasts longer than it should. So back to the bus. The person sitting in the seat says it's all the bus driver's fault. Let's find this bus driver and teach the bus driver a lesson, so that when there's pleasant scenery, to slow down. When there's unpleasant scenery, to speed away. In the simile, that's trying to control your happiness and suffering. So you can always experience more suffering. Sorry, no, didn't mean that. They can always experience more happiness and less suffering. So you want to find out who is driving you. What is this will which drives you, your intention, in Pali, Jhetana, the bus driver of your body and mind? In the bus, eventually you find the bus driver's seat, the one driving your life. This is what you do in meditation. You go deep inside of yourself till you find who is driving you. What is this will, intention, choice? Who is doing this decision making? Back to the bus. When you find the bus driver's seat, you get one of the biggest shocks of your life. You get the insight which changes the way you look at the bus. Because when you find that bus driver's seat, you find it's empty. There's no bus driver there. When you go deep in your meditation, you find there's no one inside driving this bus. It's cause and effect, running according to nature, dependent origination. The result of that is that you go back in your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. You stop the craving. That's called the simile of the driverless bus. When you see no self, the empty bus, or rather the driverless bus, then you stop trying to control your journey. You let go, and soon you gain full enlightenment. Going to the source of things sees the emptiness at the heart of you. Do you understand? I'll give you one last story before I close up this evening. This was a story from my own life, one of those wonderful occasions with my teacher Ajahn Chah. You can't get more profound than this. When my teacher started to become sick, in our monastery, which was about 6 kilometers from his monastery, the monastery where the Western monks were being trained, we built a sauna. The idea was twofold. One was to help our teacher, because saunas were allowable in the time of the Buddha, and they're supposed to be good for your health. Maybe this will help Ajahn Chah have a long life. That was reason number one, service to our teacher. Reason number two, if our teacher came for his sauna, we'd also see him once a week and he'd always give a Dhamma talk. That was a selfish reason, to get our teacher to visit once a week. And it worked so well. He'd come every week to take his sauna. He'd give a Dhamma talk first of all, and then we'd go to the sauna, help him do our services, like help wash his bathing cloth, hand him his towel, that sort of stuff. And it was great to see your teacher once a week. On this one occasion, he came for his sauna, he gave this amazing Dhamma talk. Sometimes he was on form, it's beautiful stuff. After the talk, I was so inspired that I knew those other monks would look after him. I went behind the hall and just sat meditation instead of helping my teacher. Because of my inspiration, I had a wonderful deep meditation. It was beautiful. When I came out of the meditation, I was by myself, there's no one around. The first thought which came up, I wonder if my teacher is still in the sauna. Maybe I can go and do my services now for him. So I started walking from the hall to the sauna. I was too late. Ajahn Chah had finished his sauna because I met him on the path. We crossed paths. He was coming with 2 Thai men on his way back to his car to go back to his monastery. And so we crossed. He was coming with two Thai men. I was going the opposite direction. There are times when your teacher looks right through you. That was one of those occasions. He stopped and he bored right into me with his mind. Because he saw through the smile on my face, I just had a very deep and powerful meditation. So he decided to try and enlighten me. He looked at me again, holding my eyes with his own, with his great power, and said, "Brahma Wangso." This is what he said in Thai. I'll translate it into English. He said, "Brahma Wangso, why?" He asked me the question, why? It was a moment to try and make me a full arahat. I replied, "I don't know." And he did just what you did. He started laughing. Because I was just being stupid. I was still a young man. I didn't understand the answer to the question, why? My goodness. But out of the great compassion which a teacher has, he smiled and he looked at me again and said, "Brahma Wangso, I'll tell you the answer." It is great. From a great arahat, he told me the answer to the great question, why? He said, "If anyone asks you that question again, this is the answer. The answer to the question why is..." You ready for it? The answer to the question why... I don't think I should tell you. Okay. The answer to the question why is... there's nothing. That's what he said in Thai. "Mai mi alai." Emptiness. There's nothing. And then he looked at me. "Do you understand?" I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." And then he went away. So that's the answer to the question, why? There's nothing. "Do you understand?" "No, you don't." That's a powerful, deep answer. There's nothing. No one in here. Anatta, sunyata, emptiness. That's the deepest answer. If you go to the center of things, Yonis Manasika, a work of the mind which goes to the source, that's what you find. There's nothing there. And I'll leave you with that to go home with. Good night. Okay, now, we usually like to share merits, so we'll do the sharing of merits now. I'll do the chanting, you can please follow along with me. This is sharing the merits of listening to the Dhamma with all our departed relations and other beings.
Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, 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 sadhu.
And for those of you who like to come again tomorrow night, it's the way we look at life, otherwise the five hindrances. And I'm not sure if this list is actually on the... have they put this list on the board? Yes, the list is on the board here, the talks for the next few days on the evening. So it's all about meditation, enlightenment, deep teachings, but try and get a bit of ordinary teachings with them as well. So have a nice night. See you tomorrow. Maybe. Good night.